reminder, welcome back to The Late Debate with Cormac O'Hara. You can contact the programme this evening by text 51551, email latedebate@rte.ie, and you can follow us on Twitter at latedebate.rte. Well, as you heard there, Michelle Mulhern's constituency office was set alight this evening around 7 o'clock or so. If there's any further development on that story, we'll bring it to you. But I assume the politicians around the table are aghast at that story this evening, Piers.
Oh yeah, I think I've just heard it coming through on Twitter and then just heard it on RTE. I think it just defies logic that what's been reported is criminal damage, that somebody would try and set fire to a constituency office of Michelle Mulhern. I know there's been a lot in the media in relation to Michelle Mulhern in the last number of days, but to go to such extremes over something like that, if that's what the motivation was, what people are linking now is just bizarre.
Okay, well, that's all the information we have. If we do, as I say, have more information, we'll bring it to you, and I'm not going to go around all the panel at this stage. Okay, but let's move on to our first topic, because President Michael D. Higgins was attending a function at Cullaghte Óin and Finglas in Dublin last Thursday. His car was engulfed by anti-Irish water protesters shouting various slogans and some profanities. Now, footage of these protests has now emerged, seemingly recorded by the protesters themselves and posted on the internet. The president's wife, Sabina, was with him. I'll get your reaction to this in just a second, but have a listen.
You little media parasite!
Who are you?
You traitor!
Shame!
Who are you? Get the fuck are you doing?
Now that's a taste of some of the protests in Finglas last Thursday. President Michael D. Higgins attended a function, as I said, in Cullaghte Óin. He was accompanied by his wife, Sabina. Paul Murphy of the Anti-Austerity Alliance. You don't condone that, I assume.
I don't condone the personal abuse at him, directed at him, at his size, etc., etc. I think that's inappropriate, completely unhelpful. I defend the right of people to protest, including against the president. I don't think it's particularly purposeful. I think the main thing we have to do now is to prepare for, you know, a massive campaign of non-payment. That's how this will be beaten. But there is actually a huge amount of anger out there at the president for signing the second piece of water charges legislation.
But surely the president, his office is above the cut and thrust of daily politics. So why would you defend the right of those people to protest against the president's attendance at a function?
Well, I think people have a right to protest, full stop. They have a right to protest at whatever target, in a democratic, peaceful way, at whatever target they choose. The rights or wrongs, tactically, of who they choose to target is up to themselves. But there is an anger out there because the president signed the legislation. He signed it into law.
I wonder, do protesters feel they can resort to such profanity? Resort to such, use that type of tone when protesting, even against the president, because of the protests in Tallaght when the Thánaiste, Joan Burton, leader of the Labour Party, was stuck in her car because of protests for over 2 hours.
No, I don't think so. I think people are very, very angry, okay? And anger is directed in all sorts of directions, including, in this case, at the president. I mean, if you're connected to any, like, anti-water charges groups on Facebook, you see just a huge anger at Christmas time that, for some reason, people had some illusions in the office of president and some idea that Michael D. Higgins would stop this going through. He obviously didn't. We knew he never would, that he wasn't going to resign over this, which is the only real option that would have been open to him if he wanted to make a statement on it, which I think he should have done. But it was never going to happen, but it's a sign of the anger.
Profanity, no, but the tone of this protest was okay, according to you.
No, I'm defending the right of people to protest. To the extent that it engaged in personal abuse, I disagree with it. But
the tone of what was being said...
I disagree with the personal abuse that was directed against him. But I
see no connection whatsoever between the Tallaght protest and this in terms of tone?
I don't. I mean, well before any protest happened in Jobstown, there were protests against politicians people were extremely angry.
Well, I mean, I think it's important to say that the people involved in this protest are the people at the heart of it, right? The people filming and shouting, at the president. like, they're not representative of protesters. They are a small group of people. You know, I know who they are. I have been at the other. I've been at the receiving end of their tactics, and that is their tactic. You know, they've been doing this for a couple of years.
Sorry, how do you know who they are?
I know because they have done, like, they have, and I mean, they're linked to the people that were out in Jobstown, right? And some of the people, I'm not saying all, but one of the. One group of people out in Jobstown, and you know, they're at other protests, but they're just
are they a political grouping?
They're political, but they're not necessarily affiliated with one political party, right? They aren't affiliated. It's not that they're not necessarily, but their tactic of this particular group is to you know, shout at you know, film. Generally, it's been politicians, and to shout at them when they're doing that. And like, for example, like I spent a day where I had to, like, they had threatened to go out to my clinic. And I spent a day avoiding them and kind of turning up my clinics and seeing if anyone was there, you know, and before I go in, you know, hoping to miss them because they are actually quite intimidating. And then I got caught by them.
Do you as a representative feel threatened by them then?
Well, I did. I found it at the time. And I thankfully, I shouldn't say this too soon, but they moved on from me. But like, but I mean, one day they got me.
Why did they target you?
Because I was a government politician. That's basically it. That I was picked out because I was a government politician.
No, was it because of Irish
Water? And mainly because I was Labour at the time.
Because you were supporting Irish Water, is that right?
It's broader because they have other issues apart from Irish Water and they protested on other issues.
Fidel Mahaly-Eames, and I'm not sure if I gave the names of the panel at all, but I'm joined by Paul Murphy of the Anti-Austerity Alliance, Fidel Mahaly-Eames, Independent Senator, Joanna Tuffy of Labour and Piers Doherty of Sinn Féin. Apologies if I didn't do that earlier. Fidel Mahaly-Eames, you wanted to get in on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I actually think this conduct is out of line when it comes to the President and his wife. They're our first citizens in this state. They're senior people. While I think it's okay for people to register their feelings, I think the language and the approach really does matter. After all, the president was elected by, I think, more than 1 million people in this country. Now, having said that, I'm one of the people that led a petition to the president on the water. And I was disappointed that, shall we say, on a matter of what I considered national significance, that he didn't, shall we say, give it more time and, you know, refer it to the Council of State, because I think that's the
request. Why would he do that?
Well, the three reasons we put before him, 12 senators signed the petition that I organised and put together and mailed to him, was that, first of all, that we felt that the plebiscite in the bill wasn't strong enough to ensure that water would be kept in public ownership. Neither, we thought it was absolutely appalling that Irish Water wasn't under the scrutiny of the CNAG, the Controller and Auditor General. I mean, that's absolutely outrageous, given that this is public money and taxpayers' money, and that it was a regressive tax. Whether you were a millionaire or someone on the breadline, you ended up paying the same amount of money. For those reasons, we felt, look, it's worth putting this to the president.
The president obviously must have considered this. He didn't think it was appropriate to refer to the Supreme Court. Did you, I wonder, ramp up expectation, thus inflaming these protesters?
Look, I accept it's the president's prerogative to make that decision. It was the first time I ever did, you know, was involved in a petition of that type. And I certainly didn't do it with any intention to ramp up expectations. It was a call to the president to say, consider this.
Okay. Now, a number of political groupings, the Anti-Austerity Alliance, People Before Profit and Sinn Féin, called people to protest over many issues. Now, before Christmas, we had a major protest in this country, Piers Doherty, over Irish Water. Gerry Adams spoke at that. He whipped up the crowd. He said he was angry about Irish Water. I wonder, can you draw a direct line between that and the protests that we've seen around the president's car and his wife with him as well? Is that acceptable? And are politicians, Sinn Féin politicians, whipping up anger? And this is the result.
Well, I think you could draw a direct line if you were living in Cowd Cuckoo Land. But, you know, here on planet Earth, there is no direct line. I was at that protest. I've been at many other protests against water charges. And what was actually quite evident from that protest at Merrion Square is the carnival atmosphere, the friendly atmosphere, the poetry, the dance, the music, all of that
the
was
anger.
Taking place. And the anger. The anger wasn't being whipped up by politicians. The anger is to be felt in every single community right across this state. That's why so many people have come out in their local communities against water charges. That's why they will be coming out again this weekend.
The anger was being whipped up. Gerry Adams said, let's give them a message pointing to the Dáil.
Yes, and the message is very clear. Sinn Féin are giving them a message along with others. The people travelled in their tens of thousands from across the country to actually send a message to the Dáil. Gerry Adams was standing in solidarity, as were others on that day with them. I don't think anybody had to whip up the anger against water charges of the thousands that were there outside the Dáil on that day.
But I wonder, when a senior politician like Gerry Adams whips up anger like that, can some people in the crowd misconstrue the message?
No, I don't think so. Because, like, what would you expect, Gerry Adams or anybody else to say, well, thanks for turning up. I hope you have a nice day and be safe on your way home. The message they wanted to hear from their because they wanted to hear from their political leaders and their civic leaders, from the community leaders who stand with them against water charges, and to continue to pledge support for this fight until water charges are abolished. And that's what Gerry Adams was talking about, that if we were opposed to the water charges, we will continue to stand with the Right to Water campaign. And if we are in a position to be elected to government, we have made it a red line issue that we will scrap water charges. And the type of protest that we've seen there, the type of protest that I've been involved in Donegal, we have another protest there this weekend. There's protests happening every single week. There is none of that type of tone, sentiment, language that you've played on the clip here. And I don't defend that.
But it's in Sinn Féin's anger to whip up anger on this. It's in Sinn Féin's interest to whip up anger on this, isn't it?
No, it's not. Because for a start, I think that actually if you have protest that it takes it to an extreme, then it is actually counterproductive to the campaign in itself. Because what you have is, and we've spent 15 minutes talking about a number of protesters that protest against the president, and that is newsworthy, and I'm not saying it's not, but that is a very small minority of the tens of thousands of people that come out on nearly a weekly basis now to protest against Irish water and do it in a very cordial way, make their point very, very solidly against
say,
Irish
water,
water charges.
I suppose what I'm thinking really here, listening to the type of protest against the president there, it reminds me of what happened with Joan Burton. It was at a level that was unacceptable. That is intimidating. Certainly, I wouldn't like to have been trapped in a car for two hours. I think...
And who's to blame
I saw
that,
the protest on the streets outside Leinster House. That was more of a... it was almost like a carnival. It was much more peace. It was absolutely peaceful, even though there were some very strong speeches. But who is to...
Who's to blame for that? Is anyone to blame for that? I know Paul Murphy was there, but I'm not laying blame at Paul Murphy's door. But I wonder if national parliamentarians have a role in calming these situations down.
Well, I think, I suppose the very fact that people haven't felt listened to for quite a while is certainly, you know, it's making people feel like us and them. And, you know, that has been a feature of this government at different times. I have felt it myself.
The protests are not new, and we've had massive marches in the past where we have had this kind of thing. And, like, I don't think you can draw a connection between, you know, Sinn Féin mobilising their people on this, or even Paul, you know, even though I would have been critical about comments he made about the thing Job's done, I don't think he was behind it. But there are individuals behind it. But these are organising. These people are very deliberately organising this kind of behaviour. They have a tactic. I'm not sure what their goal is, right? But I don't think, you know, you can link it up with protesting or what the opposition is doing in general, to be fair. But there are certain people, there are certain individuals, and I think it's very important that the likes of Pearce and Paul and other people in the opposition, including Fidelma, would very much condemn this and distance themselves from it, which they have done.
What about Fidelma Guillaume's point that, listen, at the end of the day, this is about Labour in government, Fine Gael in government.
You haven't heard what I said.
Listening to people. And people said to you, in your clinic, I assume as well, they said to you face to face, I can't pay these charges, but yet you voted in favour of forcing them to pay.
Yeah. Well, in fact, your clinic, that's not the kind of issue you would be faced with. But people, my constituents, would have said it to me. But the thing about it is like, but we,
Joanna,
well, this, Fadana,
down,
just
Joanna,
like,
this did go
yeah,
on
but
for
Fadana,
one
you had a good,
year.
You had a good amount of space
year.
There.
And
yeah.
I mean, when the bill went through the
yeah.
first time.
But this group, actually, this particular group of people have been organising for much longer than a year, and they've been protesting on other issues as well. You know, and many of us have got to know them quite well, right? But the point I wanted to make is that we have a very, you know, open and accessible political system. People come from other countries and they can't, you know, they say, I can't understand, you know, in my country, which I've come, in the country I've come from, the politicians go around with bodyguards and you can't get near them and they're all very rich. Now, to be fair, people might think that here, but I mean, when you look at some other countries, there's a much greater gap. We have an accessible political system.
Do we, I wonder?
We do. We have very robust debate and, you know, people have huge power at the ballot box and they'll tell you what they think, but they're not, you know, aggressive, and they don't intimidate and frighten
but,
you,
hold
and they
on,
don't
hold on a minute.
Stop you from going to your clinics or going to meetings or award certificates.
It's one thing having a political system that where politicians are accessible.
Yeah.
It's another thing making a blind bit of difference or being effective. Yeah. So people spoke with you. They said, I can't pay this water charge.
Well, they did make a blind bit of difference.
I mean,
there's massive changes in relation to the water charges.
Hold on a second. Oh. 1 year ago, Cormac, when the bill went through in December 2013, it was rammed through the Dáil, I think, in less than 4 hours. It came into us in the Seanad. We had about 16 hours debate. No matter what questions we asked about the cost, for example, that would be put on the Irish people, we got no answers.
Yeah, well,
that's why some of us and the independent benches, quite a lot of us, voted against the bill. We warned the government that it wasn't going away because of the feedback. And sure
okay,
enough,
and
a year later,
is, Joanna,
why are people surprised?
Ipso facto, people don't feel listened to.
No,
hence, we have protests like tonight.
No, yeah, that's true.
Week.
And I think, you know, behind it, like, it's like there is a background in terms of the great, you know, upheaval we've gone through as a society and how that's impacted. I do think that's behind it. But I mean, at the same time, you know, it's, I don't think you can say, well, that's all the fault of the government, because the government was in the context of having to deal with a particular economic and crisis,
Paul Murphy,
and recession.
See, the anger that exists out there, it's not whipped up by Sinn Féin or by the Anti-Austerity Alliance or someone else. That's always, there's a trend of explaining history by saying, or of protest, that it's like outside agitators cause these things. It's not possible to cause demonstrations of tens of thousands of people with an organisation the size of the Anti-Austerity Alliance or with an organisation the size of Sinn Féin. It speaks to the enormous anger that's out there as a result of austerity upon austerity. Then they start talking about recovery. People don't feel it and they impose a water charge.
Okay, well,
that's
the
reason.
They're not the same as the people out taking the videos and shouting at people.
Okay, we'll discuss that further in an Irish context and in a Greek context in just a second. But first of all, 51551, Eleanor in Cork says, because someone is angry doesn't give them a right to behave as these people did. If a four-year-old behaved like that, we would not say it's okay because they are angry. Another texter, Paul Murphy, Uachtaráin na hÉireann is above politics. Ministers are not. Protest them. You need to condemn the abuse of the president. And Kieran in Tralee says, water protests are nothing like what took place in Greece. What really upsets the establishment, including media, is that working class are organising outside their prescribed role and refusing to be told. Syriza showed the way, says Kieran. Well, that brings us neatly to Greece, because the Alexis Tsipras, the new Prime Minister of Greece, announced his cabinet today. But will the new kids on the block, I wonder, how will they fare against the old heads of the European Union, Paul Murphy? You were there, you've just returned from Greece. Will they have the bottle, do you think, to face them down and ask for a write-down of their debt? Because that's what they're looking for, big style.
I think what happened on Sunday is historic. It opens a whole new chapter in Europe. It opens a chance for other left governments to come to power. And it opens a chance to build a very fundamentally different type of Europe. It places the question of debt in the centre. It doesn't answer any of those things. It opens the possibility of doing those things, because the reality is that the likes of Merkel, the likes of Draghi, the likes of Juncker, they do not represent, in my opinion, ordinary people, the 99%, the working class in Germany or anywhere else in Europe. They represent the interests of the bankers and the bondholders, and they're going to defend those interests.
What was the mood like in Greece? Before we get to the nuts and bolts of debt renegotiation and all that, what was it? You were there over the weekend. What was the mood like?
A mood of hope, a mood of expectation, but also a certain determination. People know that it'll take a movement from below to be able to defeat austerity, that electing a government like Syriza won't be enough by itself. I thought that there was a rumour that circulated on the night of the election that gave a very good insight into attitudes of people, which is that there's a group of workers from the ERT, which is the equivalent of RTE, which was shut down a couple of years ago by the Samaras government. And there was an occupation by the workers of their headquarters. They tried to keep running it for a while, and then it's run on a different basis now by those workers. But there was a rumour that on election night they were going to go and reoccupy their headquarters. In the end, I think the riot police knew about it, so it didn't happen. But it showed that it raises people's expectations, and now there'll be a movement from below to demand that Syriza implements its promises.
But has Syriza raised expectations far too much now? Can they deliver?
But people have a right to expect not to have half the country living below the poverty line. I mean, that's not an incredible expectation. The right to expect that the minimum wage will be raised from €400 a month to €750 a month. The right to expect that people would have access to some form of social benefit. So,
but the right
it's necessary
to reduce the national debt by half.
The debt is not going to be paid. The debt is twice the size of the entire economy almost. It's incapable of being paid, and so it's not going to be paid.
Germany says it has to be paid.
Well, it isn't going to be paid. That's the question.
Piers Dorney is laughing at that. Why are you laughing, Piers?
Because everybody knows that Greece cannot pay the debt. Like, this isn't, you know, this isn't something new. It doesn't take you to have a PhD in economics to understand this. The debt that has been foisted on the Greek people is far too big. And Syriza have come to power on a promise to negotiate that debt. There's been a lot of misunderstanding and misrepresentation of what I believe is Syriza's position. They're not going in there demanding that Europe write off their debt. They actually have a well thought out policy that isn't just in their interest, but actually in the interests of indebted countries right throughout Europe.
It involves investors losing a lot of money.
No, it actually doesn't. It actually,
how does it not?
Because what Syriza, what is at the focal point of a proposal that has been put forward in Greece is that the ECB would buy the debt of Euro member state nations that is above 50% of GDP, that they would hold on to that debt, that you would pay zero interest in that debt, and when that portion of debt became equivalent to 20% of your GDP, then you would be forced to buy it back. So
paying zero interest on that debt is a change in the conditions, meaning that the investors, they didn't ask for 0%. They asked for more. They're losing money.
No, the investors don't, because the ECB buys the debt. So all investors get paid. Everybody gets paid.
So the ECB, and then basically the taxpayer, the European taxpayer, is funding that.
The ECB isn't funded in that way. So therefore, the ECB, for example, as a central bank, can't go bust. It doesn't matter if it's making losses in its books.
Print more money. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the ECB have just after committed to printing 1.6 or so trillion euro to invest into banks in the hope that it trickles down.
So another couple of hundred million doesn't make a difference.
No, it actually would be quite big, but what this would do is actually it would have immediate benefit in terms of investment to the country. So let's look at what the Greek economists are putting forward.
It's hugely risky, Piers.
Well, it's not risky, actually. It's hugely beneficial if we were to support it, because the problem at this point in time is our government won't even support the idea to talk about this here at a European level.
Why would they, though? If you did that, you would possibly devalue the euro further, would you not?
Well, the euro,
you might have a run on the banks.
The euro has been devalued, and indeed, objective to devalue the euro so that exports will increase and so on and so forth.
At a certain level.
And why would you have a run in the banks? Because the ECB is backing everybody. Nobody gets burnt in this proposal. But what it would
investors
mean for Ireland...
Investors would lose money. They certainly would, Piers.
Can I...
Not only investors,
sorry,
but the European taxpayer.
Well, first of all, if Fidel Mahaly Eames has read the 33-page proposal that had been put forward, then I'll go into debate with her. But I would suggest that you haven't read the proposal.
How would you know?
Well, if you have, maybe, because the comment that you've made couldn't be made if you have read
Finish
the proposal.
Finish your point and I'll respond.
Well, the point I'm making is investors don't get burnt under this proposal, because the ECB buy all of the debt that is above 50% of GDP ratio. What would that mean for Ireland? It would mean that about 60% of our debt would be bought by the ECB. We would pay no interest in it until it equated to 20% of our GDP, which means we would pay no interest for 40 years. What would that mean in terms of debt servicing costs? It would mean that our debt servicing costs would be reduced each year, annually, by about 4 billion euro. That's 4 billion euro that's freed up in this economy to invest in the real economy.
How much, the nuts and bolts of this, how much would the ECB have to buy?
It's in the region of about 4 trillion euro.
In the context of the eurozone?
Right across Europe. And one of the major...
4 trillion?
One of the major beneficiaries of this year would be Germany.
The ECB would be on the hook for 4 trillion euro.
Yes.
So you're talking about devaluation of the euro by that much?
No, because...
Can you not see private markets running a mile from this?
No, because what happens if you look at the proposal, what happens is that it's not a case of printing 4 trillion euro. It's about also reducing liquidity in the ECB by buying money off investors, that you actually destroy money as you're creating money. And one of the...
Is this not fantasy?
No, it's like, not.
Sinn Féin are accused of fantasy economics many times. So you'd be buying all of these bonds, right? And you'd be in the back burning them as well.
No, if you want to simplify that there to that extent, then that's fine. But then you could say the same thing. The ECB has come out with a proposal to create 1.5 so trillion euro over the next number of months and to invest into banks, hoping that it will get trickled down into the real economy. That isn't fantasy. You believe that many people believe that is sensible and all the rest.
Are they going to be burning it at the same time?
It is called quantitative easing. When the money comes back, they burn it again. Yes, they destroy it again. That is how money works.
Quantitative easing in America worked because money was printed and there was huge liquidity in the system, but also investors took a haircut. And you're saying nobody takes a haircut here.
No, the only thing that happens is that the debt is, there is no interest in the debt. It's a zero coupon bond, and it is a zero coupon bond for as long as the debt is too large for your economy to handle.
So it's brought to zero from?
It is brought to zero from the interest rate at this point in time.
Okay, so who loses that money then?
The ECB. The ECB lose on their interest.
You're saying the ECB doesn't lose money because they're burning the money at the back.
No, what happens is that when your economy grows to a certain level, that you're forced to buy the bonds back. So therefore, the bonds aren't written down. The bonds still exist. There is just zero interest in them. And this is something that can happen.
If it was this simple, why didn't the ECB do this a couple of years ago?
If you look at
you said 4 trillion euro.
Yeah.
Why didn't they buy bonds all over the shop? Greece, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, 4 trillion, 5 trillion, 10 trillion euro. And then burn it.
That's what they're actually doing at this point in time. They've just announced that they're going to buy 1.5 trillion euros worth of bonds, but they're going to buy it from banks. It's not going to be for national governments. What has happened in Greece is about a quarter of a billion euro has been foisted onto the Greek economy. And how much of that actually went into the Greek economy? About 10%, because the rest of it was to pay interest rates on debt that was already there and accumulated more debt in Greece. And that's why everybody knows that Greece will not be in a position to
Joanna
pay back
Tuffy,
its debt.
Is it that simple?
No, I don't think it's that simple. I think everybody would agree that that something should be done to help Greece, and the new government have said is that they are going to negotiate. They changed their policy from 2012, and it's very much they will negotiate. Something in relation to negotiation, by definition, means that they don't know what the outcome of the negotations will be.
But they want a reduction.
But
in
they want debt easing.
Would you support them?
Of course I would. I mean, I wouldn't be prescriptive
Does the government?
We all got debt easing as it stands, and it was very beneficial to Ireland. Anything that can help the Greeks, I think will be a good thing.
Does the government support the debt conference?
Well, yeah, I mean, they don't have it. The government doesn't have a problem.
Enda Kenny in the DAW has explicitly not supported it. But it's madness.
Yeah. Minister Michael said
he does support it in general.
He said not yet.
But then Enda Kenny in the DAW said
so. I think Antonisha, your leader, does support it.
Well, she does. Yeah, she does. I suppose I could only
Michael
speak
Noonan
for
in general. Enda Kenny, no. Is that right?
I don't know. I don't know the detail.
And
I just know that
Joan Burton, yes.
Yeah.
So does the government have a coherent position on this?
Well, I mean, I think the main position of the government would be that they welcome, there's a new government in place and they would like them to be able to negotiate a programme
that
will help them
on the debt conference.
No, well, it's getting too focused. Why is the debt conference this solution to all ills?
It's a question with focus, and I want a real
answer. Well, I only can speak for the Taoiseach, but I mean the point is.
What do you mean you can only speak?
I can only speak for the Taoiseach. She has said that she's favourable to the idea.
What's the government's position?
I don't think it matters. It's a total red herring in my view.
It's hundreds of millions of euros.
No, but let's get.
I'll tell you why it matters, Joanna. I'll tell you why.
Yeah, but you should let me answer though.
I will, but I'll tell you why it matters, because Minister Michael Noonan said that we could be on the hook for 350 million euro. So if the Greeks want to reduce debt, it matters to us.
Well, I think there's going to be two parties to the negotiation. I don't think that something's going to be agreed that will be damaging to the eurozone, right? There's a lot of issues around, like things have stabilised a lot. But can I just make a point? Syriza are in a situation now where they're in government and they've said they're going to negotiate, right? The only people they can negotiate with are is the Troika, mm-hmm. because they're in a situation to do what they need to do as a country. They need to probably go into a new programme. They need refinancing. And, you know, like they are going to have to
they've
negotiate
explicitly said
the debt.
They're not. They're saying goodbye to the Troika, and that's
no,
and that's
not.
What they are,
oh,
and they've
sure
said no,
well,
well they are,
they
and I'll explain what they
well,
mean by that.
They're refusing to deal
yeah. with the Troika officials, the likes of AJ Chopra, who come here and demands austerity policies, and they're saying let's deal with this on a political basis. Okay, and that's what the victory of Syriza does. It puts politics back into this. This isn't a technocratic question about the most responsible right policy to do, which is always austerity. It's a political question. And they're saying, let's discuss it on a political basis. And so, yes, they'll go and they'll discuss with the President of the Commission, Juncker. They'll go discuss with Merkel. They'll discuss with Draghi. But also the point is, Joanna said it's a one-on-one negotiation. It should not be. It should be a negotiation of all those indebted countries and the countries, the creditor countries. And that's the point, is that a big opportunity has opened up to massively reduce Irish debt. And the position of the government, it's completely in contradiction to the interests of the mass of people in Ireland. The government's interest is that there's no good deal
yeah,
for the Greeks.
Because it
will damage the reputation yeah. of the government.
How will
so, because they've said that the best way to get a deal is to be the good pupils of Europe, and we had a seismic shift, blah, 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 and they got basically nothing. Then the Greeks go, elect a radical government, get a deal, and so that's why. But if the government actually represents people, then you join in the call for debt conference now.
I mean, the Troika is not separate from the European Union. The Troika is made up of, you know, it's the European Commission and the ECB
and the IMF, which is nothing to do with the European Union.
But the point is, yeah, I know, but the point is, they will need a new programme from the Troika to do the things they need to do, to refinance, to keep the whole debt rolling over and, you know, to keep their banks running and all of that kind of stuff. So in that context, there will be give and take, you know. And I mean, I suppose the main thing is...
He said they'd wave goodbye to the Troika.
They can't.
No, they won't.
They can't wave goodbye to the Troika.
They can't, because they can't borrow anywhere else.
For
they can't borrow anywhere else.
In February 2015, which is next month, they were expected to exit a 240 billion EU IMF Troika bailout. I mean, that the state, Greek state debt is about 320 odd billion euro. And 70% of that Greek debt is owned by the European taxpayer. And
so
Ireland,
what? So what?
No, Ireland is into that for even 350 million.
So what's your point?
Okay, I'm just trying to describe the scale of the problem.
But you said they have no option. Why couldn't they say to hell with the Troika?
I didn't say they have no option.
And where would they get money from?
Hold on. Let me explain.
Not
I'm not saying they have no option. Here's what I'm saying. The Greeks are our fellow EU citizens. They're in deep, deep trouble. The people are having a terrible time, as others have said. 25% of the unemployment, 40% youth unemployment. Welfare is, I think, 300 a month. After a year, it stops. You've got addiction. You've got prostitution. You've homelessness. The economy is structurally very weak. You've got only about 25% of the people paying tax. You have high levels of corruption. You have a civil service that isn't even able to collect taxes because there was a feeling that Syriza was coming into power. People stopped paying their taxes. So you have a wave of populism that has brought in this government. But Syriza now has to negotiate.
What does that mean? What does that mean? Does that mean a huge reduction in debt, in your opinion?
He is looking for a huge reduction in debt. I believe what I'm hearing is that what will be open to him, maybe a debt holiday, an easing of the interest rates and an extension of the term. It's going to be very difficult for the EU, IMF, to give a debt write down to him if they don't also look at Ireland, Spain and Portugal. And I believe this is why I do support the debt conference, because I believe that Europe should not be splitting debtors and creditors. There should be a conversation where, for example, our debt is examined. Because let's face it, we're the only country that saved the entire European banking system.
Would it be irresponsible, Pierce Doherty, for the government to support calls for a debt conference in Europe?
It would be irresponsible for them not to. It is in our benefit to have the issue of a debt conference tabled at ECOFIN. We should have done it ourselves, but now we have a Greek government democratically elected as of Sunday, that are going to table that proposal. And there's been a lot of talk in relation to what Syriza's doing and what Syriza's demanding and all the rest, and it's, you know, it's showdown at noon and all the rest. That's not what's happening. Syriza will, in my view, stand up for Greek interests. They know that they have a big, big challenge ahead of them. They're up against very, very many leaders of member states that are pro-austerity. They don't have allies at this point in time, and that is where you would be expecting that Ireland, which would be in their beneficial interest, to support them in terms of a debt conference. But the newly appointed finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, anybody who knows that individual, he is cool, calm, he knows what he's doing. He is a trained economist. He left his job a couple of weeks ago to run for Syriza, and he's the finance minister today. I invited him on behalf of the party to Ireland in 2011 to talk exactly about what needed to be done in terms of Europe, what was happening in Greece, what was happening in Ireland in terms of the mountain debt problems. Syriza is not looking from a nationalistic point of view of how just to benefit Greece, because they understand that the problems of Greece can only be resolved in the European context, and it has to be beneficial to Europe.
This is what disconcerts some people about Sinn Féin. If you were the Minister for Finance now, and if you jumped in with two boots and said, look, we support a debt conference, we support to look at looking at the issue of debt right across the European Union, would our borrowing costs not rocket?
No, why would they? Because, like, this is what happens in national parliaments. This is what happens when you elect governments, that they represent the interests of Irish people. So this is the type of discussions that we should have. Should we have a finance minister that just says, well, we've 110% of debt to GDP in Ireland. It's costing us €8 billion a year to service it, but let's not talk about it. Let's just keep it quiet. Of course, this isn't about sticking it up to Europe. This is about having a discussion with colleagues and basically convincing them that it is in the interest of Europe as a whole to have a write down of our debt, because the levels of debt that Europe, member states in Europe, is carrying is unsustainable. It's not just Ireland, it's not just Greece, it's Portugal, Spain, it's Italy, it's countries like that there that have far too much debt and who are being then forced to have austerity policies implemented them, so-called reforms, which is about privatisation and weakening the economy further, and therefore they're in this spiral of debt. Okay. We had the finance minister coming back from ECOFIN time and time again saying that they agreed a new rescue package for the Greek people, which would see their debt reduced. What has happened is the debt has actually increased. Greece holds more debt today. Two people a day are taking their lives in Greece. 50% of young people are unemployed. Mm-hmm. Our government had a hand and part in this here. There's no way that they can absolve themselves, because they sat down in the room and believed.
51551. Tom in Dublin says Irish politicians degraded Irish people by imposing unfair debts on them for generations. Reap what you sow, he says. And Alan in Sligo says the policies of Sinn Féin and the anti-austerity alliance will be put to the test in Greece. I don't believe that we should give up on the €350 million we are owed by Greece. It's a dangerous precedent. Does Paul Murphy or Piers Doherty?
Nobody. This is a red herring introduced by the minister, because as I've already explained, and if you listen to the finance minister again, he is making it very clear to any media that's willing to hear him, they're not looking for other member states in Europe to bail them out. They're basically saying that what happened in the past is too much money was thrown at Greece and it wasn't going in the right direction.
I want to move on, Jonathan,
I think that Pearce and his party are very much using what's happening in Greece for their own political ends. You know, they're fighting the battle that they should be having in terms of debate here out there, because Ireland's situation is so different from Greece. And, you know, it's very complex. Ireland is not in the same situation as Greece. It's in a very different place. And the thing about, and even in Greece in itself, it's quite complex. They have some favourable conditions. They have a low interest rate on their debt, lower than Ireland, not much higher than Germany. So there are, and they've got managed to stabilise their finances. You know, like there is scope for improvement.
I think the point is,
if there is an easing of their situation, it won't necessarily benefit us because we are already much further ahead.
Okay, well,
we're borrowing on the private markets. We're getting favourable rates, and we have, we've no more austerity.
Okay.
Piers Doherty mentioned
privatisation. I want to stick with Joanna Tuffy of Labour for just a second. Over €300 million is an awful lot of money. It's the money we could get as a state if we sold our stake in Aer Lingus.
Yeah.
Should we?
Oh, well, yeah, that's a good question. I suppose, personally, I'm very favourable to holding on to state assets, you know, like that's my inclination. And, you know, I think, you know, I think the government should strongly look at, you know, the benefit of holding on to the stake and how
they
it might
seem
be beneficial.
To be moving in, in a different
yeah,
direction.
We don't know what the story is going to be. We don't know what the decision is going to be. But personally, I'm very favourable to holding on to stake because I just have that, you know, that's my view. Not everybody even agrees with me within my party. Like, I have a tendency to favour holding on to state assets where possible.
So if the expert review group come back and say, look, sell our 25.1% yeah. stake in Aer Lingus,
yeah.
Will you vote against it?
Well, no, I mean, I'm not going to preempt it, like, because I'll have to take into account, like, you know, the decisions this government has taken, you know, in relation to state assets already that I've had to take in the context of the overall decision that's been made and whether it's for the best, you know. So, like, I wouldn't preempt what decision, but I will be working collectively with my party.
Surely you know all there is to know now to make that decision in principle.
No, I don't.
What's outstanding?
I don't. Well, I mean, I, you need to see what is the proposal. You know, like, I think it has to be really scrutinised as to whether it's beneficial from a strategic point of view. And
you
have to look at how it'll impact
now.
On the workers and, you know, routes out of the country and so on. Like,
But you can make up your mind on all of those points.
No, if it was my choice straight off, I would say no, but like it's not a principle in the sense that it was already privatised.
It's not set in stone.
No.
Now, if it came to the crunch, I'll ask you again, and if the government want to move ahead and privatise the rest of Aer Lingus, would you move on your principles or would you say, no, I'll row ahead with this?
Point of principle, but I would tend to favour holding on to that stake.
What kind of Labour Party do we have? You know, and I know Joanna is setting out a case that she actually is in favour of it. But even she who's doing that is saying, well, it's not really a principle. I mean, yes, we already have largely a partial privatisation of Aer Lingus, massive attacks on working conditions over years. But the idea that a Labour Party in government would stand over the sell-off of the rest of it, I mean, it's unbelievable. And it's no wonder people are moving away from
it. At the same time, you don't hold state assets just for the sake of it.
No, but it's
not. You have to look at what's the benefit.
But maybe
we need new state assets.
Let's look. Yeah, do we really think they're going to sell it and buy other things? Obviously not.
The state needs 330 million euro.
This isn't an abstract thing, okay? We can look at IAG has bought other companies in the past, other previously state-owned airlines. IAG bought Iberia Airlines. They laid off 4,500 workers. If they laid off a similar proportion of workers in Ireland, you're talking about I'm not at all. That's based on fact. Over 1,000 workers would be laid off.
To make a judgment on that, we'd have to have the balance sheet of Iberia in front of us and compare it with the balance sheet of Aer Lingus. You haven't done that, have you?
Impact have done that, and they've talked to analysts in Spain, analysts here, and that's their estimate of it, and I trust their decision on it. We know strategically how important the Heathrow slots are. We know how important it is for Cork region. We'll probably get a promise that they won't be lost immediately, but you can't control what you don't own.
Yeah.
You hand it over to a company that's run on the basis of profit, and we know what'll happen. And just that the last point is that this is part of the same austerity agenda. Joanna says that austerity is over, but the debt is used as an excuse to transfer assets from public hands into private hands so more people can make money, so you have a general downgrading of wages and conditions.
Cormac, I just want to come in here for a second on this issue. I want to know, what is the advantage of selling Aer Lingus to the state? 330 million, I would question that is... That it would be worth it. I mean, the Heathrow slots are gold.
You'd question what?
What the value of the 330 million would be to the state. In the last term, for example, the last quarter, Minister Noonan himself said he took in 1 billion more in taxes than he expected. To sell out on our stake in Aer Lingus is really to sell out on our connectivity to opportunity.
Is it really?
Absolutely it is. Let me give you an example.
Can we not get to London, for example, from Dublin?
There's more to Ireland than Dublin. Up and down the West Coast, we have Knock, we have Shannon, we have Cork. And they rely completely on connectivity.
What does that mean?
What I'm saying is this. For example, I can think of people right now in Galway, in Oranmore, where I live myself, and one member of the family, often the male, flies to the UK for work, uses that linkage. I heard an analyst...
How would the sale of Aer Lingus impact that?
Less less flights. Like the,
how do you know less flights?
Because if you're listening to the analyst, Cormac, on this, so the routes into Dublin are probably secure, but the routes in Knock and particularly Shannon are not. It would mean less connectivity, fewer routes.
Is that a fair point, Joanna Duffy? And Piers Doherty as well?
Yeah, look, I find it actually hard to argue in relation to the sale of Aer Lingus, because to me it just makes so much sense. And in fairness, I've heard all of these, the parties that are in favour of it now, arguing completely the opposite way when we had this debate a number of years ago when Fianna Fáil were looking at the sale of the shares. So it's really hard to take them credible, because everything that they said at that point in time, Fine Gael and Labour, about the strategic importance, about an island nation, about the Heathrow routes being, you know, being so valuable that they're the gateway to the rest of the world, are still as relevant today. There is absolutely no reason to sell off Aer Lingus. And, you know, the counter-argument...
Is Sinn Féin saying no to €330 million when we have a million people living in poverty in the country, which could go a long way to alleviating
that? Yes, we're saying no to that. Because there's certain things in this country that are above money. I'm sure that we could get a price from Dennis O'Brien or others for RTE. I don't think we should sell RTE. I don't think we should have a monopoly there. I don't think that we should sell other valuable state assets such as our water infrastructure.
This is very interesting, because there's a lot of things. We have other alternatives. We're not being totally isolated if we sell the 25% stake in Aer Lingus. Number one, there's no guarantee that the slots to Heathrow will be gone.
Yes.
We'll also have other options in terms of airlines to fly into to Heathrow and London. So you're saying no.
Not necessarily.
You're saying the market decides, yes. So you're saying no, surely. You're saying no to 300 plus million, which could go into the pockets of your constituents in Donegal, and you're saying no to it.
Yes, I am saying no to it, because the risk that you're taking with that decision to sell off, to lose the last shares that we have in Aer Lingus, is far too risky. It is, because there is no guarantee that we would lose the Heathrow slots. And if we lose the Heathrow slots, it's not just an issue in terms of tourism and connectiveness. It's about investment into this country, because that is the gateway into the rest of the world. Like, it is crucially important. We are an island. Are we going to depend on Ryanair and we're in a situation where you have another privatised company? And then the counter-argument from government is, well, we're a minority shareholder anyway. Well, if that's the case, why doesn't every company just hold 51% of shares if it's
not
a case?
Of course you have influence when you have that.
Look, I know Joanna is rattling with her conscience and her principles in relation to this here. Look, it's very simple to me. If Joanna was in opposition, she'd be very vocal against this. She's caught in a bind. Her party's in government, and the Leave party.
Well, I mean, yeah, when you're in government, obviously, you can't just unilaterally make a decision as a party. Like, Pearce has that same dilemma up in the north. You know, that's it. You have to compromise when you're in government. And, you know, you can't just, you can't make the decision for the government. You have to wait until the decision is made collectively. But obviously, I'll be having an input in my own party as to what I feel about it.
Okay, John says in Boyle in County Roscommon, nobody seems to want to discuss the elephant in the room, the fact that Greece has a huge black economy and that an awful lot of Greeks don't like paying any tax. So why should taxpayers in a compliant country like Denmark or Germany have to pick up some of the Greek tab? As a taxpayer in Ireland, I wouldn't be too happy about it, just as I'm not happy about paying for Mr. Paul Murphy's water.
But Syriza is campaigning on a programme of ending tax evasion. A huge amount of where they're anticipating revenue will come is ending tax evasion. It's a situation like we had here with the PAYE tax marches in the 80s, whereby the only people who are paying taxes are workers. Businesses aren't paying any taxes. They're the ones who are evading tax in Greece. And so, I mean, a key part of the Syriza program is tax reform.
Okay. I'll move on to another topic. 51551. An awful lot of people in the country, especially first-time buyers and others, were afraid of their lives about the central bank's announcement, which came today, on mortgage lending and limits and so on. It was initially said buyers would have to have a 20% deposit. Now, they say first-time buyers, anyway, will be able to get mortgages of up to 90%. Will it make it easier, I wonder, for people, first-time buyers especially, to get mortgages, Joanna Tuffy? And I wonder, is that what we really want?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a compromise. I think it's reasonable, you know. I think to go to the 20% straight away, like, would have been very harsh on people in the market at the moment. You know, so, like, it's... like, I think it's fairly reasonable. I was looking at the average house, price of a house nationwide. It seems to be under 200,000, you know. And like, I had a look at some properties out in my own area in Newcombe, where I live myself. And, you know, I think what's proposed would make it a lot more manageable for people who wanted to buy in, you know, in the commuter belt and places like that, you know, where you would get a lot of first time buyers. So,
It is great as well. You can get a 90% mortgage if you're a first-time buyer.
Yeah.
And the lower end of the scale is you can get a 30%. You have to have a 30% deposit if you're an investor.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough, to be honest. I think that's reasonable.
There's a question on this now as well, Piers Doherty. If you are, for example, stuck in negative equity and you want to move house, you'd like to buy another house, but you can't afford to sell your own home, because if you did, you'd be hit with a huge amount of negative equity. Would they be considered investors? Would they have to have a 30% deposit then?
No, I think there's rules, and this is supposed to be underpinned by legislation, but there's rules that will deem with that. They wouldn't be buy-to-let. That's what would be the investor, so it wouldn't be that case. They wouldn't fall into that
but
bracket.
You'd be leaving your first house to let, wouldn't you?
No, because in that case, you would have to actually sell your first house. If they were trading up or trading down, you'd be selling your house.
I'm not talking about people who are trading up or down and selling their house.
You would be an investor, for example. It's not investor. It's basically you're not a first-time buyer.
So if you're in negative equity, for example, if you're in a house in Dublin and you're in negative equity and you can't sell that house, but you'd like to move on. So what you do is you rent the house you're in and you move, say, closer to work or whatever, and you buy a new house. You'd be classed as an investor.
Well, if you're in negative equity and you're buying a new house, then you have no problem with getting a loan. So therefore, you can be in negative equity and be one of the wealthiest people in the country.
Yeah.
So like, it's not a case of, in terms of debt sustainability is the real issue here.
Yeah, but you could have, you could be in negative equity and have bought the initial house and just be a married couple. You move on, years pass, you have children, you want to move to a bigger house, for example.
Yes.
You'd be hit a number of times there, wouldn't you?
No.
Huge negative equity, and if you wanted to buy a new, bigger house, for a moderate lifestyle, you'd have to have a 30% deposit.
Well, that's only if you were holding on to your first house. And as I said, the only way that you would do that is to have a loan.
The first house, unless you were in debt or in arrears the kind of scenario you're outlining would be somebody presumably who's in mortgage arrears and is having a difficulty repaying.
Not necessarily.
So
mortgage,
in that situation,
No. Hold on.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, the situation I'm outlining is somebody who can pay the mortgage.
Yeah.
But is in negative equity. Now, if they sell house number one. And let's say they lose 50,000 or 70,000 euro on it. They can't do that. They can't afford that. They can't afford to take that hit. What they want to do, for example, is to rent house number one, buy house number two, but they can't do that because they'd have to have a 30% deposit under the new rules. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I'm not really sure, like, with that situation. Certainly
first-time buyers. This is where Holohan has listened to concerns about first-time buyers here. And, you know, he's saying a 10% deposit is okay for up to 220,000.
You see, the kind of person...
Sorry, if I could just finish. Yeah. I think what's good about this proposal, Cormac, is that builders will now build to that price.
The whole concept behind this is to actually stop house prices running away. This is about stopping a credit-fueled housing bubble. And there's concern that we're about to enter into that period. We've seen house prices increase by 22% in Dublin, 15% nationally. It is out of kilter with what should be happening in the economy. And while it gets people out of negative equity, it is not good for individuals. So research done, for example, by Dr. Ronan Lyon suggested that a 5% increase of loan-to-value ratio would increase the house price by 10%, and the opposite is the same effect. So if you decrease loan-to-value by 5%, it would actually suppress house prices by 10%. And that's what this is all about. It's keeping house prices low so that young people in the future can afford to pay them and can afford to take out mortgage that they can pay into the future.
Well, could it have, Paul Murphy, unforeseen consequences? Fianna Fáil said that the central bank rules on mortgage lending could potentially result in thousands of non-first-time buyers being trapped due to the onerous 20% deposit rule.
But should there they be selling a house? The normal person will be selling a house to buy a new house.
Who's the normal person?
No.
What if you're negative? You can't sell.
But what you're talking about is somebody who would basically hold on to their house, rent it, and buy a second house and have two properties. But that's not the norm.
Hold on a minute.
Do you know what I mean? Situation where you might be outlining is where they are in some difficulty in relation to repaying their mortgage. And in that case, there's alternative arrangements in relation to the banks and the whole market.
They might have to hold on to the first house because of the amount of negative equity.
But how would they get
Paul Murphy,
they get a mortgage to buy a second house?
Because they can pay the first debt, right?
How can they pay it if they're going to keep it? The
two of them have jobs. The market says they're in negative equity. They want to move to a bigger house because they have children now to be closer to work for whatever reason.
But the sensible thing would be to sell their house and get a new mortgage for the second.
Paul Murphy.
There's an element here of, well, if I wanted to go to there, I wouldn't start from here, whereby you have a number of problems in the housing market built up. And I think, I mean, the approach of a graduated approach to first-time buyers under a certain amount, non-first-time buyers, investors, there's a sense to that in terms of trying to put a cap on the whole thing, try not to have a credit-fueled bubble without, which is the worry, without having a situation where people simply can't afford to buy a house, people who have saved, etc., etc. So in general, moving to a situation of higher deposits, deposit required, makes sense. The only problem is given the nature of the housing market and the need for people to have homes. And so, like, the answer to all these questions isn't fundamentally found with tinkering this stuff. It's found in increasing the housing supply. It's found in a massive program of house building by the state.
But just in that case of the two houses, if somebody can get a mortgage to buy a second house, you know, then they're in a different place. They are not in difficulty. Yeah. You know, do you know what I mean? We're not here to kind of help people, move to a bigger house and keep their original house and get a mortgage. I would
put a bet with you. There are thousands of people in your constituency in West Dublin who are screaming at the radio now, who cannot believe that you don't get it.
Well, I don't think you're right, because the people I deal with in that situation, it's usually that they're in negative equity and the situation is they can't repay their mortgage. So if they can't repay their mortgage, they're not going to get a mortgage for a second property.
Fianna Fáil said this evening, Michael McGraw, this could result in an entire generation of people being trapped in houses and apartments which are no longer suitable for their needs, even though they have demonstrated a clear capacity to meet their existing mortgage
repayments. Well, Fianna Fáil have a great record on this, haven't they? You know, think about it. Their policies on property and mortages, you know, have a lot to do with where we are.
We're forgetting the purpose of all of this. The purpose was to prevent another credit-fueled bubble and to make home ownership possible for first-time buyers. And I think it's striking a balance there.
Okay. Buy-to-lets always had a loan-to-value ratio higher than 90% anyway. And these rules aren't as simple and as hard as fast as they may be presented on by us tonight, because there is leeway in all of this here. In buy-to-let, it's 10% that you can breach the rules, and in family homes, it is a higher rate. I think it's about 15%.
Okay, let's have a quick look before we finish up tonight. Tomorrow morning's front pages. The Irish Independent leads with terror for TD Mulhern as office bombed. Last minute reprieve for first time home buyers. New central bank mortgage rules will hit city house hunters hardest, and Labour under pressure to block sale of Aer Lingus. Well, we felt a little bit of that pressure in studio this evening. The Irish Examiner leads with TD defends Higgins abusers, anti-water levy demonstrators target protester, and I'm not sure, I can't make out
it's Paul a misrepresentation Murphy. Of my position, that is headline, because I spoke to Sean Connolly earlier on today and I said exactly the same as I said to you, and I don't think TD defends Higgins abusers is an accurate position, because what I said, I defend the right of people to protest, but I don't agree with personal abuse, etc. So it's okay, I don't know if he wrote the headline, but he probably wrote the story.
That people can read the front page in its entirety tomorrow. Muirchus la Shinchatadola Paul Murphy on AAA on Shannador Fidelma Healy Eames Niavs Bloch Joanna Tuffy O 40 in Loch Daibda August Pyrrhus O Doherty O Hin Fein Bamajanashilish Demoirach Igdech Logdishin Slonigis Banacht.